Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Yes, fine, the business and economic news of the day. Also, though, a breakfast burrito. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Riznell. It is Thursday today, the 27th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. If yesterday was a corporate news kind of day, which we said it was, today is an economic indicator news kind of day. A second look at gross domestic product for the first quarter came out this morning. An unchanged from earlier but still robust 6.4% growth on an annualized basis in this economy. Annualized is important there. First-time claims for unemployment came out as well, because this is Thursday. The trend keeps going in the right direction. Relatively is doing a lot of work there. Low, 406,000 people applied for benefits. We, though, will begin with something called personal consumption expenditures, PCE, if you like. It measures inflation and was up 3.7% in the first quarter. Now, why are we telling you that? Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
The Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, the PCE, tracks a basket of products and services.
You can think of it like one big shopping cart for all Americans.
Economist Claudia Somm at the Jane Family Institute says the PCE measures the price of the goods and services we consume, whether or not we pay for them ourselves. At the doctor's office, the copay comes out of your pocket, but if you have insurance, that pays the rest. Somm says higher demand pushed up the prices in the PCE basket.
A lot of people need to go buy clothes to get back to work, and frankly, like myself, a lot of us need clothes that are of a larger size than we were wearing the last time we went to work.
Now, the PCE is the Federal Reserve's favorite inflation snapshot. The PCE's flashier cousin, the CPI, or Consumer Price Index, only measures what we pay for ourselves. Stephen Cicchetti is an economist at Brandeis University.
Well, the reason that they look at the PCE instead of the CPI is that the PCE is a more accurate measure of the whole market basket of what we consume.
Kathy Busjancic, an economist at Oxford Economics, says the PCE also tracks consumers who buy chicken when the price of, say, beef rises.
The PCE price index will capture that switch to the lower cost good.
The Fed needs an accurate inflation gauge like the PCE to know when it needs to raise interest rates to cool off the economy. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Let's keep going with the economic indicators then, shall we? That first-time claims number, 406,000, as I said, the lowest since the pandemic started, and a pretty solid sign the labor market is working its way back. But, A, we are nowhere near labor market normal, and B, that first-time claims number is a look back, what already happened. And with 24 Republican governors having said they are cutting off extra federal unemployment benefits, some as soon as next week, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino looks at the labor market yet to come.
It's not just that extra $300 a week in federal unemployment payments most of these states are ending. It's also benefits for gig workers, freelancers, and the long-term unemployed, like Marcellus Rowe in Dunwoody, Georgia, where federal benefits will end June 26th.
I will be receiving nothing, unfortunately. I have no idea how I'm going to live day by day.
Rowe lost his job at a public transportation agency last year and says he hasn't found work to match his previous pay of $16 an hour.
$10 an hour is just not going to cut it.
As economies reopen and the dangers of the virus recede, Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute says the additional benefits are doing more harm than good.
I see a labor market where employers clearly want to hire workers, but there are not enough workers there to be hired.
He says scaling back benefits could incentivize more people to return to work. But Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation says it's not so simple.
We want to believe that we can just turn the lights back on, but that's not really how it works.
Industries like tourism and entertainment have been slower to bounce back. And some people face health challenges or childcare issues caused by the pandemic that prevent them from finding work.
Those are the ones on the federal programs. Those people that have the greatest barriers to work.
Rising vaccination rates might make it feel like we're done with COVID, but he says COVID isn't done with the economy. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, the major indices were up a bit, so there is that. You know what else was up too, though? Almost 36%. AMC, the movie theater chain that not 6 months ago was this close to bankruptcy. Why? Reddit, Wall Street Bets, is at it again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's rare, honestly, that corporate governance becomes a big news story. It is equally rare, more rare probably, that in a David and Goliath Wall Street shareholder fight, David wins. But that is exactly what the vote to put at least two new, more climate-minded people on the ExxonMobil board of directors yesterday was. And the ruling in the Netherlands that Royal Dutch Shell is responsible for climate change and is going to have to cut its emissions by a lot. And soon, well, that's of a piece. But for those precedents and for the tipping point that arguably yesterday was, the big question here is scale. Will what happens in a boardroom and a courtroom get us to the changes that are going to matter to the planet? Marketplace's Scott Tong explores.
For big oil companies with giant climate footprints, yesterday's events are a kind of push and pull. At least that's how environment and climate lawyer Maggie Peloso at Vinson & Elkins sees it.
The litigation is really using the law as a push.
That is, the Dutch ruling against Shell may prompt other oil majors to cut their emissions.
And the shareholder piece of it is kind of trying to use shareholder preferences on climate as a pull. So you're trying to get people to go beyond the law and do more than what the law would require.
Peloso expects the new board members, voted in by big investors, including BlackRock, to push for strategic changes. But they'll have to be big, according to the International Energy Agency. Last week, it said in order to achieve zero net emissions by 2050, no new oil and gas fields can be developed, period.
And so if that's the world you're living in, you would expect that investors will question every single new investment.
But it's not just what oil companies stop doing. It's also the technologies they develop. For instance, finding ways to pull CO2 out of smokestacks in the air to turn emissions negative. Here's Karen Daney-Kiley, senior analyst at S&P Global Ratings, a marketplace underwriter.
In terms of capturing carbon, they're not quite there yet, but there's an incentive now more than ever for these oil companies to figure it out.
Figure it out and move the climate needle. But not all fossil fuel companies can be poked and nudged by big investors in Wall Street. Columbia Law Professor Michael Girard.
We also have state-owned oil companies from Russia and Saudi Arabia and other countries that are much less vulnerable to this kind of political pressure.
And to many observers, big oil's business models have to fundamentally change if we're going to dial back the warming already underway. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you need business and economic news early of a weekday morning, might I recommend David Brancaccio and the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. We started with economic indicators. We shall continue now with economic indicators. Says the AAA, more than 37 million people are expected to travel this Memorial Day weekend, down from the before times, yes, but still a 60% bump from 2020. So getting where you're going is going to be comparatively crowded. And once you get there and step up to that rental car counter, oh, it's going to hurt a little bit, as Marketplace's Sam Fields reports.
It turns out most people tend to book trips in pretty much the same order. Plane tickets first, then hotel or Airbnb, and rental car last, sometimes weeks or even months later, says Jonathan Weinberg, CEO of the rental car site Autoslash.com.
That is definitely not going to work this year.
This summer, he says,
you're going to need to check your car rental rates before you even book your airfare. Because in many cases, car rentals are extremely high or they're not even available.
Especially in Florida and other prime vacation destinations. Josh Rosenbaum found that out the hard way. He's flying from Phoenix to Orlando this weekend, and he booked his flights and hotel a couple of months ago.
And then I thought, oh, the rental car, that'll be no problem. It never has been a problem. I'll go on Hotwire or...
But when he went to book something last week, instead of the $30 to $50 a day he was used to...
They're about $140 to $150 a day, but... with the city tax and the airport surcharge and this, that, and the other, it ends up being about $600 for a three-day weekend.
Way more than he was banking on. A lot of people have been unpleasantly surprised lately when trying to book rental cars. Paula Twidale at AAA says rates are topping out at $134 a day.
It's a lot more for people to get their arms around, not anticipating that sometimes renting a vehicle for 4 or 5 days can be more than the airline ticket.
Prices are up because there just aren't enough cars to meet demand right now. Chris Waronka, a leisure analyst at Deutsche Bank, says there are three main reasons for the shortage.
Number one is the car rental companies, all of them, sold a bunch of cars throughout 2020.
When demand for travel plummeted.
We ended 2020 with about 33 to 35% fewer rental cars than we started 2020.
Number two, Waronka says, rental car companies didn't anticipate that demand would come back as quickly as it has.
We have seen travel improve every month in 2021, but it really started kicking into high gear when people started to be fully vaccinated.
And number three, he says, as the rental companies saw demand coming back,
they tried to buy cars. They couldn't get all that they wanted.
Because of the computer chip shortage that's forced automakers to shut down some production lines. Put all that together and you have higher prices pretty much everywhere. In some places, there are no cars to be found at all, says Paula Twidale at AAA.
In Anchorage, Alaska, there are dates in July that there are no cars available by any car company at that point in time.
That's also true around some national parks, which are very popular right now, and in Hawaii. Brittany Martinez is going to Maui for her honeymoon this summer. She booked everything a couple of months ago, but even then, the rental car was much more than she expected.
It was like over $1,000 for a week. When I saw $1,000, I was like, oh no, this is way too much.
So she started looking at rental places away from the airport and found a car for a bit less, $600 for the week instead of $1,000.
I was like, I'll book this and I can always shop around and see if there's anything that comes available.
But when she checked for something cheaper last week,
then there's no cars available. It's saying that there's no vehicles available based on the criteria I've entered.
For mid-August, 2.5 months from now.
Glad I booked it.
After a lot of stress and searching, Josh Rosenbaum also booked something, finally, for his trip to Florida this weekend. But not through a rental car company. Instead, he found something for about half the cost on Turo, which is kind of like an Airbnb for cars. He'll be renting a Mustang from a stranger for $70 a day. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up,
one of our best concepts is Badass Breakfast Burritos.
Good idea. Tasting pretty good, too. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 141 today, 0.4%, finished at 34,464. NASDAQ basically flat, 13,736. S&P 500 pocketed 4 points, about 0.1%, 4,200 on the nose there. General Motors is digging its way out of that semiconductor chip shortage we've been telling you about. The company says it's going to be able to reopen 4 plants in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico next week. Shares in GM up 2.9%. Investors sure do seem to like the electric vehicle plan that Ford unveiled yesterday. Told you a little bit about that. Shares up for the second straight day, 7% today. Rental cars, Sam Fields was talking about that. Avis Budget Group added 1.5% today. Bond prices down. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.60%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, we've got some business to wrap up before the holiday weekend. Marketplace is a nonprofit newsroom, and your donations are an important part of our budget. Every dollar you give goes right back into keeping everybody informed about our changing economy and our changing world. To stay on track with our budget, we're looking for 4,000 investors to join or renew by the end of this week. And I hope the next one is you. So please give right now at marketplace.org/donate. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A couple of weeks ago, I was over in Pasadena and walked up to what could have been just another retail storefront, but wasn't.
Capriati Sandwich Shop, Jailbird, Dinah's Chicken, Wendy's, Sam Sailor Thai Street Seafood, Fresh Brothers.
This place has not one, but about 20 separate restaurant brands advertised outside.
Greenleaf, Trejo's Tacos, I know what those are. Roy's Artisanal Creamery, the Halal Guys, Panini Kebab Grill. You know what occurs to me? I forgot to bring lunch today, so I'm definitely getting something to go downtown.
The company behind that unusual storefront is called Kitchen United. They've got a handful of places around the country just like this one.
What you're seeing here in the front of the house is, you know, an area over here to the left where
shelves.
Drivers will come directly in.
Badass and Breakfast Burritos is having a busy morning.
Badass Breakfast is having a very busy morning. Yeah.
That's Michael Montagano. He is the CEO. Kitchen United is what's known in the industry as a ghost kitchen provider. They rent space to restaurants to do takeout and delivery only. Some from delivery apps, about 40% or so from the company's own platform.
And the last part, where you're actually sitting,
I can do walk in and just do it myself on the kiosk.
Are our kiosks. And so yeah. We have a fair amount of walk-in traffic as well. So, you know, I guess contrary to misconception in the market, at least the way that we see it, is that a ghost kitchen is actually a way just for consumers to have choice on how they want to consume their food and provide a tool for restaurant brands, which you'll see,
yeah,
large and small, to be able to capture that new demand in a CapEx light efficient way.
All right, let's go have a look. Let's
right.
do the nuts and bolts. As we pass by the shelves with Postmates and Grubhub and DoorDash all waiting to be picked up.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So here at the front of house, we staff it. So you'll notice that Denise is our general manager. And
hi, Denise. How are you? Good to see you.
Good, thank you. I'm going to hand you that hairnet before you go.
Oh, okay. Oh, it's a hairnet, right? It's a food facility, of course.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Let me do the hairnet thing. And,
sure.
And let's go through the door, shall we?
Yeah, that's great.
All right.
So we're walking into the back of house. We're managing the front of the house. We're doing the cleaning, sanitization, food receiving in the morning, so they don't have to staff someone at 5 or 6
infrastructure,
a.m.
Right?
All the infrastructure.
Right.
But our restaurant partners are doing the cooking. This is a way for them to enter into a new trade area without having to invest in the usual infrastructure, but also the timing. Many cases, you know, it's $1 million, 12 to 18 months.
Right.
In this case, most of our restaurant brands are able to begin serving within 60 days with less than $10,000 of expenses.
That's not bad.
Nope, it's great. So we're looking at here, we're walking into One Kitchen, which is the Doghouse brand.
Oh, yeah.
And this is Adam.
Hey, Adam. Hi. How are you? I'm Kai. Good to see you.
What's up, Kai?
Not a man. Just doing a little walk and talk. Tell me who you are and where we are.
I'm Adam Gertler. I'm the culinary director for Doghouse.
For those who aren't familiar, what's Doghouse?
So Doghouse, we're like a group of restaurants. We actually started in California 10 years ago. We started in Pasadena, actually. So our original stores are right
back
here.
Back to your roots.
So we've kind of expanded and franchised throughout the country. We have almost 50 stores now. But here in Kitchen United, we actually opened up here in 2019 to test new brands. Right, to test new concepts that we wanted to spin off and possibly offer to our franchisees
so
as alternate brands.
Walk me through that. You didn't want to take an existing facility and turn that into your test bed. You said, look, I can go in here and not have to spend a lot of money setting up and just run some culinary experiments.
Exactly. So when you think about what we need to do to set up like a brick-and-mortar Doghouse where everything is designed very specifically for that brand, something like this, we could test out a new brand, have it up digitally, have it on a menu, have it in several digital marketplaces in a matter of no time, and then test it out.
How much time is no time? Seriously.
I mean, really, in a matter of weeks. Like, in this facility right now, we're doing 7 brands. So this is like 7 restaurants in this very tiny little space right here.
Okay, hang on. How can that be? Explain that.
Well, basically, we use the core ingredients that we would use at a doghouse, right? So we're not bringing in a whole new slew of products when you start. So, for example, one of our best concepts is Badass Breakfast Burritos,
yep,
which you see cranking here.
I do. There are a bunch out front, too. It's a big day for you guys.
And they're awesome, right? And that also, that does 2 things. That capitalizes on their whole morning, the whole breakfast where, yep, Doghouse wasn't open. And the only item we needed to bring in.
You're expanding your day part, right?
Right.
In radio talk, yeah.
And literally, tortillas, those large flour, right, tortillas, are the only thing that we wouldn't use in the actual Doghouse menu. Right.
Let's say Badass Breakfast Burritos tanks.
Right.
And you're out of it with basically minimal investment.
Very minimal investment. You turn it off. Now, our original intention was to workshop these for months and months, yeah, in this facility. But when the pandemic happened, we knew that we were going to have to triple down on the delivery business. And it really helped a lot of our stores stay alive.
Huh. Adam, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Thank you very much.
See you. Sure. Take care. All right, I got to get a burrito on my way out. Let's go look around some more.
Sure.
So we've got like vertical rows of kitchens right here. These are like galley kitchens. Now, is this one over here Doghouse as well, or is this somebody else?
So this is Doghouse.
Right.
This is the Halal Guys.
And then another one down there and another one down
there. That's exactly right.
So look, this is great for the companies, right? CapEx light, and they just come in and really quickly without a big footprint. And it's, in theory, great for the consumers. Seems to me, though, that taking the actual restaurant part out of this means you need fewer people and you don't actually employ as many people. Great for companies, maybe not great for the workers.
You know, we employ over 50 people in our centers, and our restaurant partners employ dozens within these centers. We actually view this as a job creator for market because we're bringing in new restaurants. And the interesting thing is that it's all incremental in general to their existing four walls. It's not going to replace brick and mortars. I come from a restaurant family. The dining room is going nowhere, and we're super excited to have rushed back to dining rooms, you know, over the past month.
Yeah.
But there is a change in consumer behavior on whether they want to be cooking at home.
You said you came from a restaurant family?
I did.
This strikes me as the opposite of a family restaurant.
You know, I would beg to differ on that.
Oh, come on. Look around. This is it. Come on.
Well, look, does it have the traditional sense of being able to come and dine in?
Right.
No, but I think, you know, food takes shapes in many different forms, and it's important that those local family operators who we support are able to capture that new demand in a meaningful way, and we've been a very successful tool in helping them do that.
All right, walk me back to the lobby and answer me this question.
Sure.
Are you a food company or are you a tech company?
Look, we sit at the intersection of food, tech, and real estate. That's the difference, is that we're bringing together three things that historically aren't seen as one, but seen as three separate. And there's an incredible amount of inefficiencies that come out of that. And so what we're doing is marrying all three together and then, you know, centralizing that,
right,
except, of course, preparing the food.
Yeah, which clearly Adam is just digging in there. That was crazy. That was crazy. He was going a million miles an hour. Okay, no joke. I'm going to order a burrito on the way out. How do I do that?
Oh, sure. Let me walk you through it.
Well, how you do it is you go over to one of those kiosks.
I don't want tater tots in my burrito. What is that?
You got to embrace it.
No, I don't.
No, I don't.
God, they've all got tater tots in them.
I paid $15. Yes, $15 for a breakfast burrito. Gave him my email address.
I don't want to receive communication. Sorry, man.
Oh, come on. I thought that
Sorry,
was
dude.
I,
yeah, you know. I,
and in probably less time than it does take for the average order, Adam's team had it right off the grill and into my hands.
Well, Michael, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai. Thanks for coming to paying us a visit.
It was fascinating. Totally fascinating. And I got lunch out of it.
Though, honestly, the tater tots were a bit much, I got to tell you. This final note on the way out today, in which the Secretary of the Treasury is dead to me. Janet Yellen spent some quality time with a House Appropriations Subcommittee this morning. Standard battery of questions, inflation, infrastructure, all y'all know the drill. Also, though, this from Congressman Mark Pocan of Wisconsin.
Yeah, I was just in the 10, 12 seconds I had. Are we still going to keep the penny?
I don't think there's active consideration of getting rid of the penny.
How much do you love that pause, huh? I believe I am on the record, though, on this program with my feelings about the penny opposed strongly. Also, I'm kidding about the secretary. I mean, we did that song about her, right? Google it. Trust me on that one. Okay, fine. Technically, we didn't do the song. Dessa did the song, but still, it's a good one. Look it up. Who's yelling now? All right, we're leaving. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, way macroeconomic edition. The White House is expected to release the president's proposed budget for next fiscal year tomorrow. $6 trillion in all, deficits of $1.3 trillion or more through the end of the decade. Remember, deficits are annual shortfalls. Important to note here, though, as all these stories roll out over the next 12 to 18 hours, the president can ask for whatever spending he wants. Congress gets to decide. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Niantha Parker, Beth Perlman, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.